Well, hey friends, how are you doing? This is Keith Tyler, your volunteer broadcaster, bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm going to dive right in from the best American mystery stories of the century, a story published in 1947 by Ellery Queen himself. It's called The Adventure of the President's Half Dismy. Those few curious men who have chosen to turn off the humdrum highway to hunt for their pleasure along the back trails expect, indeed they look confidently forward to, many strange encounters, and it is the dull stalk which does not turn up at least a hippogriff. But it remained for Ellery Queen to experience the ultimate excitement. On one of his prowls, he collided with a President of the United States. This would have been joy enough if it had occurred, as you might imagine, by chance on a dark night in some back street of Washington, D.C., with Secret Service men closing in on the delighted Mr. Queen to question his motives by way of his pockets, while a large black bulletproof limousine rushed up to sprint the President away. But mere imagination fails in this instance. What is required is the power of fancy, for the truth is fantastic. Ellery's encounter with the President of the United States took place, not on a dark night, but in the unromantic light of several days, although the night played its role too. Nor was it by chance. The meeting was arranged by a farmer's daughter. And it was not in Washington, D.C., for this president presided over the affairs of the nation from a different city altogether. Not that the meeting took place in that city, either. It did not take place in a city at all, but on a farm some miles south of Philadelphia. Oddest of all, there was no limousine to spirit the chief executive away, for while the president was a man of great wealth, he was still too poor to possess an automobile and, what is more, not all the resources of his government, indeed not all the riches of the world, could have provided one for him. There are even more curious facts to this jewel of paradox. This was an encounter in the purest sense, and yet, physically, it did not occur at all. The president in question was dead. And while there are those who would not blink at a rubbing of shoulders or a clasping of hands, even though one of the parties was in his grave, and to such persons the thought might occur that the meeting took place on a psychic plane, alas, Ellery Queen is not of their company. He does not believe in ghosts, consequently he never encounters them. So he did not collide with the president's shade either. And yet their meeting was as palpable as, say, the meeting between two chess masters, one in Moscow and the other in New York, who never leave their respective armchairs and still play a game to a decision. It's even more wonderful than that, for while the chess players merely annihilate space, Ellery and the father of both their countries annihilated time, a century and a half of it. In fine, this is the story of how Ellery Queen matched wits with George Washington. Those who are finicky about their fashions complain that the arms of coincidence are too long, but in this case, the designer might say that he cut to measure. Or, to put it another way, an event often brews its own mood. Whatever the case, whether coincidental or incidental, the fact is the adventure of the president's half-dismy, which was to concern itself with the events surrounding President Washington's 59th birthday, actually first engrossed Ellery on February the 19th and culminated 3 days later. Ellery was in his study that morning of the 19th of February, wrestling with several reluctant victims of violence, none of them quite flesh and blood, since his novel was still in the planning stage. so he was annoyed when Nicky came in with a card. "James Ezekiel Patch," growled the great man. He was never in his best humor during the planning stage. "I don't know any James Ezekiel Patch, Nicky. Toss the fellow out and get back to transcribing those notes on possible motives."
"Why, Ellery," said Nicky, "this isn't like you at all."
"What isn't like me?"
"To renege on an appointment."
"Appointment? Does this Patch character claim I..."
"He doesn't merely claim it. He proves it."
"Someone's balmy," snarled Mr. Queen, and he strode into the living room to contend with James Ezekiel Patch. This he perceived as soon as James Ezekiel Patch rose from the Queen fireside chair. Was likely to be a heroic project. Mr. Patch, notwithstanding his mild, even studious eyes, seemed to rise indefinitely. He was a large, a very large man.
"Now what's all this? What's all this?" demanded Ellery fiercely, for after all, Nicky was there.
"Well, that's what I'd like to know," said the large man amiably. "What did you want with me, Mr. Queen?"
"What did I want with you? What did you want with me?"
"I find this very strange, Mr. Queen."
"Now see here, Mr. Patch, I happen to be extremely busy this morning."
"So am I." Mr. Patch's large, thick neck was reddening, and his tone was no longer amiable. Ellery took a cautious step backwards as his visitor lumbered forward to thrust a slip of yellow paper under his nose. "Did you send this to me, or didn't you?"
Ellery considered it tactfully expedient to take the telegram, although for strategic reasons he did so with a bellicose scowl. "Imperative you call at my home tomorrow, February 19, promptly 10 a.m., signed Ellery Queen."
"Well, sir," thundered Mr. Patch, "do you have something on Washington for me, or don't you?"
"Washington?" said Ellery absently, studying the telegram.
"George Washington, Mr. Queen. I'm Patch the Antiquarian. I collect Washington. I am an authority on Washington. I have a large fortune, and I spend it all on Washington. I'd never have wasted my time this morning if your name hadn't been signed to this wire. This is my busiest week of the year. I have engagements to speak on Washington."
"Desist, Mr. Patch," said Ellery. "This is either a practical joke or..."
"The Baroness Check," announced Nicky clearly, "with another telegram." And then she added, "And Professor John Cecil Shaw, ditto."
The three telegrams were identical.
"Of course I didn't send them," said Ellery thoughtfully, regarding his three visitors.
Baroness Check was a short, powerful woman resembling a dumpling with gray hair, an angry dumpling. Professor Shaw was lank and long-jawed, wearing a sack suit which hung in some places and failed in its purpose by inches at the extremities. Along with Mr. Patch, they constituted a delicious queer trio as had ever been congregated in the Queen apartment. Their host suddenly determined not to let go of them.
"On the other hand, someone obviously did, using my name."
"Then there's nothing more to be said,"
snapped the Baroness, snapping her bag for emphasis.
"I should think there is a great deal more to be said," began Professor Shaw in a troubled way, "wasting people's time this way."
"I'm not going to waste any more of my time," growled the large Mr. Patch. "Washington's birthday, only 3 days off."
"Exactly," smiled Ellery. "Won't you all sit down? There's more in this than meets the eye." "Baroness Check, if I'm not mistaken, you're the one who brought that fabulous collection of rare coins into the United States just before Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia? You're in the rare coin business in New York now."
"Unfortunately," said the Baroness coldly, "one must eat.
And you, sir, I seem to know you."
"Rare books," said the professor, in the same troubled way.
"Of course, John Cecil Shaw, the rare book collector. I've met at Mims and other places. I abandoned my first theory. There's a pattern here, distinctly unhumorous. An antiquarian, a coin dealer, and a collector of rare books. Nicky, whom have you out there this time?"
"If this one collects anything," muttered Nicky into her employer's ear, "I'll bet it's things with two legs and hair on their chests. A darned pretty girl."
"Named Martha Clark," said a cool voice, and Ellery turned to find himself regarding one of the most satisfying sights in the world.
"Ah, I take it, Miss Clark, you also received one of these wires signed with my name?"
Oh, no, said the pretty girl. "I'm the one who sent them."
There was something about the comely Miss Clark which inspired, if not confidence, at least an openness of mind. Perhaps it was the self-possessed manner in which she sat all of them, including Ellery, down in Ellery's living room while she waited on the hearth rug, like a conductor on the podium, for them to settle down in their chairs. And it was the measure of Miss Clark's assurance that none of them was indignant, only curious.
"I'll make it snappy," said Martha Clark briskly. "I did what I did the way I did. First, I had to make sure I could see Mr. Patch, Baroness Check, and Professor Shaw today. Second, because I may need a detective before I'm through. Third," she added almost absently, "because I'm pretty desperate."
"My name is Martha Clark. My father, Tobias, is a farmer. Our farm lies just south of Philadelphia. It was built by a Clark in 1761, and it's been in our family ever since. I won't go gooey on you. We're broke, and there's a mortgage. Unless Papa and I can raise $6,000 in the next couple of weeks, we will lose the old homestead."
Professor Shaw looked vague, but the Baroness said, "Deplorable, Miss Clark. Now, if I'm to run my auction this afternoon," and James Ezekiel Patch grumbled,
"If it's money you want, young woman."
"Oh, certainly it's money I want, but I have something to sell."
"Ah," said the Baroness.
"Oh," said the professor.
"Hm," said the antiquarian.
Mr. Queen said nothing,
and Miss Porter jealously chewed the end of her pencil.
"The other day, while I was cleaning out the attic, I found an old book."
"Well, now," said Professor Shaw indulgently, "an old book, eh?"
"It's called The Diary of Simeon Clark. Simeon Clark was Papa's great-great-great-something-or-other. His diary was privately printed in 1792 in Philadelphia, Professor, by a second cousin of his, Jonathan, who was in the printing business there."
"Jonathan Clark, the Diary of Simeon Clark," mumbled the cadaverous book collector.
"No, I don't know. I know either, Miss Clark. Have you?"
Martha Clark carefully unclasped a large manila envelope and drew forth a single yellowed sheet of badly printed paper.
"The title page was loose, so I brought it along."
Professor Shaw silently examined Miss Clark's exhibit, and Ellery got up to squint at it.
"Oh, of course," said the professor after a long scrutiny in which he held up the sheet to the light, peered apparently at individual characters, and performed other mysterious rites.
"Mere age does not connote rarity, nor does rarity itself constitute value. And while the page looks genuine for all purported period, and is rare enough to be unknown to me, still, suppose I told you," said Miss Martha Clark, "that the chief purpose of the diary, which I have at home, is to tell the story of how George Washington visited Simeon Clark's farm in the winter of 1791.
"Clark's farm, 1791!" exclaimed James Ezekiel Patch. "Preposterous! There's no record of,
and of what George Washington buried there, the farmer's daughter concluded. By executive order, the Queen telephone was taken off the hook. The door was bolted, the shades were drawn, and the long interrogation began. By the middle of the afternoon, the unknown chapter in the life of the father of his country was fairly sketched. Early on an icy gray February morning in 1791, Farmer Clark had looked up from the fence he was mending to observe a splendid cortege galloping down on him from the direction of the city of Philadelphia. Outriders thundered in the van, followed by a considerable company of gentlemen on horseback and several great coaches and six, driven by liveried Negroes. To Simeon Clark's astonishment, the entire equipage stopped before his farmhouse. He began to run. He could hear the creaks of springs and the snorting of sleek and sweating horses. Gentlemen and lackeys were leaping to the frozen ground, and by the time Simeon had reached the farmhouse, all were elbowing about the first coach, a magnificent affair bearing coat of arms. Craning, the farmer saw within the coach a very large, great-nosed gentleman clad in a black velvet suit and a black cloak faced with gold. There was a cocked hat on his wigged head and a great sword in a white leather scabbard at his side. This personage was on one knee, leaning with an expression of considerable anxiety over a chubby lady of middle age, swathed in furs, who was half sitting, half lying on the upholstered seat, her eyes closed, her cheeks waxen under the rouge. Another gentleman, soberly attired, was stooping over the lady, his fingers on one pale wrist. "I fear," he was saying with great gravity to the kneeling man, "that it would be imprudent to proceed another yard in this weather, Your Excellency. Lady Washington requires physicking and a warm bed immediately."
Lady Washington? Then the large, richly dressed gentleman was the president. Simeon Clark pushed excitedly through the throng.
"Your mightiness, sir," he cried, "I am Simeon Clark. This is my farm. I have warm beds, Sarah and I."
The president considered Simeon briefly. "I thank you, Farmer Clark. No, Dr. Craik, I shall assist Lady Washington myself."
And George Washington carried Martha Washington into the little Pennsylvania farmhouse of Simeon and Sarah Clark. An aide informed the Clarks that President Washington had been on his way to Virginia to celebrate his 59th birthday in the privacy of Mount Vernon. Instead, he passed his birthday on the Clark farm, for the physician insisted that the president's lady could not be moved even back to the nearby capital without risking complications. On His Excellency's order, the entire incident was kept secret. "It would give needless alarm to the people," he said, but he did not leave Martha's bedside for 3 days and three nights. Presumably during those 72 hours, while his lady recovered from her indisposition, the president devoted some thought to his hosts, for on the fourth morning he sent Black Christopher, his body servant, to summon the Clarks. They found George Washington by the kitchen fire, shaven and powdered, and in immaculate dress, his stern features composed. "I am told, Farmer Clark, that you and your good wife refuse reimbursement for the livestock that you have slaughtered in the accommodation of our large company."
"You are my president, sir," said Simeon. "I wouldn't take money."
We wouldn't take money, your worship," stammered Sarah. "Nonetheless, Lady Washington and I would acknowledge your hospitality in some kind. If you give me leave, I shall plant with my own hands a grove of oak saplings behind your house, and beneath one of the saplings I propose to bury two of my personal possessions." Washington's eyes twinkled ever so lightly. "It is my birthday. I feel a venturesome spirit. Come, Farmer Clark and Mistress Clark, would you like that?"
What were they?"
choked James Ezekiel Patch, the Washington collector. He was pale. Martha Clark replied, "The sword at Washington's side, in its white leather scabbard, and a silver coin the president carried in a secret pocket."
"A silver coin?" breathed Baroness Check. "A rare coin dealer? What kind of coin, Miss Clark?"
"The diary calls it a half dismy with an S," replied Martha Clark, frowning. "I guess that's the way they spelled dime in those days. The book's full of queer spellings."
"A United States of America half dismy?" asked the Baroness in a very odd way.
"That's what it says, Baroness."
"And this was February 1791?
"Yes." The Baroness snorted, beginning to rise. "Ah, I thought your story was too impossibly romantic, young woman. The United States Mint didn't begin to strike off half-dismies until 1792.
"Half-dismies or any other U.S. coinage, I believe," said Ellery. "How come, Miss Clark?"
"It was an experimental coin," said Miss Clark coolly.
"The diary isn't clear as to whether it was the Mint that struck it off or some private agency. Maybe Washington himself didn't tell Simeon. But the president did say to Simeon that the half-dismy in his pocket had been coined from silver he kept and himself had furnished and had been presented to him as a keepsake.
There is a half-dismy with a story like that behind it in the possession of the American Numismatic Society," muttered the Baroness, "but it's definitely called one of the earliest coins struck off by the Mint. It's possible, I suppose, that in 1791, the preceding year, some specimen coins may have been struck off."
"Possibly my foot," said Miss Clark.
"It's so. The diary says so. I imagine President Washington was pretty interested in the coins to be issued by the new country he was head of."
"Miss Clark, I want that half dismy. I mean, I'd like to buy it from you," said the Baroness.
"Well, and I," said Mr. Patch carefully,
"I would like to purchase Washington's sword."
"The diary," moaned Professor Shaw.
"I'll buy the diary of Simeon Clark from you, Miss Clark."
"Oh, I'll be happy to sell it to you, Professor. As I said, I found it in the attic, and I have locked it up in a highboy in a parlor at home. But as for the other two things..."
Martha Clark paused, and Ellery looked delighted. He thought he knew what was coming.
"I'll sell you the sword, Mr. Patch, and you the half-dismy, Baroness Check, providing..."
And now Miss Clark turned her clear eyes on Ellery.
"Providing you, Mr. Queen, will be kind enough to find them."
And there was the farmhouse in the frosty Pennsylvania morning, set in the barren winter acres, and looking as bleak as only a little revolutionary house with a mortgage on its head can look in the month of February.
"Well, there's an apple orchard over there," said Nicky as they got out of Ellery's car.
"But where's the grove of oaks? I don't see any."
And then she added sweetly, "Do you, Ellery?"
Ellery's lips tightened. They tightened further when his solo on the front door knocker brought no response.
"Let's go around," he said briefly, and Nicky proceeded with him in cheerful step. Behind the house there was a barn, and beyond the barn there was comfort, at least for Ellery, for beyond the barn there were 12 ugly holes in the earth, and beside each hole lay either a freshly felled oak tree and its stump, or an ancient stump by itself, freshly uprooted. On one of the stumps sat an old man in earth-stained blue jeans smoking a corn cob pugnaciously.
"Tobias Clark," said Ellery.
"Yep."
"I'm Ellery Queen. This is Miss Porter. Your daughter visited me in New York yesterday. I know all about it."
"May I ask where Martha is?"
"Station. Meeting them other folks."
Tobias spat and looked away at the holes.
"Don't know what you're all coming down here for. Wasn't nothing under them oaks. Dug 'em all up the other day. Trees that were standing and the stumps of the one that had fallen years back. Look at them holes. Hired hand and me dug down to most of China.
Washington's Grove, always been called. Now look at it. Firewood for someone, I guess.
There was an iron bitterness in his tone. We're losing this farm, mister, unless...
And Tobias Clark stopped. Well, maybe we won't, he said. There's always that there book Martha found.
Professor Shaw, the rare book collector, offered your daughter $2,000 for it if he's satisfied with it, Mr. Clark, said Nicky.
So she told me last night when she got back from New York, said Tobias Clark. $2,000, and we need $6,000. He grinned, and he spat again.
Well, said Nicky sadly to Ellery, that's that.
She had hoped Ellery would immediately get into the car and drive back to New York. Immediately. But Ellery showed no disposition to be sensible.
Perhaps, Mr. Clark, some trees died in the course of time and just disappeared, stumps, roots, and all. Martha?
Martha! Said the diary doesn't mention the exact number Washington planted here.
Look at them holes. 12 of them, ain't there?
In a triangle. Man plants trees in a triangle. He plants trees in a triangle. You don't see no place between holes big enough for another tree, do you?
Anyways, there was the same distance between all the trees.
No, sir.
Mr. 12 was all there ever was, and I looked under all 12.
What's the extra tree doing in the center of the triangle? You haven't uprooted that one, Mr. Clark.
Tobias Clark spat once more. Don't know much about trees, do we? That's a cherry sapling, and I set it there myself 6 years ago. Ain't got nothing to do with George Washington.
Nicky tittered.
If you sift the earth in those holes, I sifted it. Look, mister, either somebody's dug that stuff up 100 years ago, or the whole yarn's a Saturday night whopper. Which it most likely is. There's Martha now with them other folks.
And Tobias Clark added, spitting for the fourth time,
don't let me be keeping you.
It reveals Washington rather out of character, said James Ezekiel Patch that evening.
They were sitting about a fire in the parlor, as heavy with gloom as with Miss Clark's dinner, and that, at least in Miss Porter's view, was heavy indeed. Baroness Check wore the expression of one who is trapped in a cave, and there was no further train until morning, and she had not yet resigned herself to a night in a farmhouse bed. The better part of the day had been spent poring over the diary of Simeon Clark, searching for a clue to be buried Washingtonia. But there was no clue. The pertinent passage referred merely to a triangle of oak trees behind the red barn, distant 15 yards one from the other, which His Excellency the President did plant with his own hands, as he has promised me, and then did bury his sword and the half-dismy for his pleasure in a case of copper beneath one of the oaks, which he said, the case, had been fashioned by Mr. Revere of Boston, who is experimenting with this metal in his furnaces.
"Well, how out of character, Mr. Patch?" asked Ellery. He had been staring into the fire for a long time, scarcely listening.
"Mr. Washington wasn't given to romanticism," said the large man dryly. "No fol-de-rol about him. I don't know of anything in his life which prepares us for such a yarn as this. I'm beginning to think—"
"But Professor Shaw himself says the diary is no forgery," cried Martha Clark.
"Oh, the book's authentic enough," Professor Shaw seemed unhappy. "But it may simply be a literary hoax, Miss Clark. The woods are full of them. I'm afraid that unless this story is confirmed by the discovery of that copper case with its contents—"
"Oh, dear," said Nicky impulsively.
And for a moment she was sorry for Martha Clark. She really was. But Ellery said,
"Now, I believe it.
Pennsylvania farmers in 1791 weren't given to literary hoaxes, Professor Shaw. As for Washington, Mr. Patch, no man can be so rigidly consistent. And with his wife just recovering from an illness on his own birthday?" And Ellery felt silent again.
Almost immediately he leapt from his chair. "Mr. Clark!"
Tobias stirred from his dark corner.
What?
Did you ever hear your father or grandfather, anyone in your family, talk of another barn behind the house?
Martha stared at him. Then she cried, Papa, that's it! It was a different barn in a different place, and the original Washington Grove was cut down or died.
Nope, said Tobias Clark. Never was but this one barn. Still got some of the original timbers. You can see that date burned into the cross tree. 1761.
Nicky was up early. A steady hack, 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 borne on frosty air, woke her. She peered out the back window, the coverlet up to her nose, to see Mr. Ellery Queen, against the dawn like a pioneer, wielding an axe powerfully. Nicky dressed quickly, shivering, flung her mink-dyed muskrat over her shoulders, and ran downstairs, out of the house, and around it past the barn. Ellery, what do you think you're doing? It's practically middle of the night.
Chopping, said Ellery, chopping.
There's mountains of firewood stacked against the barn, said Nicky. Really, Ellery, I think this is carrying a flirtation too far.
Ellery did not reply.
And anyway, there's something gruesome and indecent about chopping up trees George Washington planted. It's vandalism.
Just a thought, panted Ellery, pausing for a moment. 150-odd years ago is a long time, Nicky. Lots of queer things could happen, even to a tree in that time. For instance,
the copper case, breathed Nicky visibly. The roots grew around it. It's in one of those stumps.
Now you're functioning, said Ellery as he raised the axe again.
He was still at it 2 hours later when Martha Clark announced breakfast.
At 11:30 a.m., Nicky returned from driving the professor, the baroness, and James Ezekiel Patch to the railroad station. She found Mr. Queen seated before the fire in the kitchen in his undershirt while Martha Clark caressed his naked right arm.
"Oh," said Nicky faintly, "I beg your pardon."
"Where are you going, Nicky?" said Ellery irritably. "Come in. Martha's rubbing liniment into my biceps."
"He's not very accustomed to chopping wood, is he?" asked Martha Clark in a cheerful voice.
Reduce those old oaks to splinters," groaned Ellery. "Martha, ouch!"
"I should think you'd be satisfied now," said Nicky coldly. "I suggest we imitate Patch, Shaw, and Baroness, Ellery. There's a 305. We can't impose on Miss Clark's hospitality forever."
To Nicky's horror, Martha Clark chose this moment to burst into tears.
Martha?
Nicky felt like leaping on her and shaking the cool look back into her perfidious eyes.
Here now, Martha.
That's right, thought Nicky contemptuously. Embrace her in front of me.
It's those three rats running out that way. Don't worry, I'll find that sword and half Disney for you yet.
"He'll never find them," sobbed Martha, wetting Ellery's undershirt. "Because they're not there. They never were there. When you stop to think of it, burying that coin, his sword, if the story were true, he'd have given them to Simeon and Sarah."
"Oh, not necessarily, not necessarily," said Ellery with hateful haste. "The old boy had a sense of humor, Martha. They all did in those days. They knew they were men of destiny and that the eyes of prosperity were upon them. Burying them is just what Washington would have done."
"Do you really think so?"
"Oh, pooh!
But even if he did bury them," Martha sniffled, "it doesn't stand to reason Simeon and Sarah wouldn't have let them stay buried. They'd have dug that copper box up like rabbits the minute George Washington turned his back."
"Two simple country folk," cried Ellery. "Salt of the earth. The new American earth disregard the wishes of his mightiness, George Washington, first president of the United States. Are you out of your mind? And anyway, what would Simeon do with a dress sword?"
"Beat it into a plowshare," thought Nicky spitefully. "That's what he'd do."
"And the half dismy, how much would it be worth in 1791?
"Martha, they're here under your farm somewhere. You wait and see."
I wish I could believe it, Ellery."
"Shucks, child, now stop crying."
From the door, Miss Porter said stiffly, "You might put your shirt back on, Superman, before you catch pneumonia."
Mr. Queen prowled about the Clark Acres for the remainder of that day, his nose at a low altitude. He spent some time in the barn. He devoted at least 20 minutes to each of the 12 holes in the earth. He reinspected the oaken wreckage of his axe-work, like a paleontologist examining an ancient petrification for the impression of a dinosaur foot. He measured off the distances between the holes, and for a moment a faint trembler of emotion shook him. George Washington had been a surveyor in his youth. Here was evidence that his passion for exactitude had not wearied with the years. As far as Ellery could make out, the oaks had been set into the earth at exact equidistances, in an equilateral triangle. It was at this point that Ellery had seated himself upon a seat of a cultivator behind the barn, wondering at his sudden accelerated circulation. Little memories were knocking at the door, and as he opened to admit them, it was as if he were admitting a personality. It was, of course, at this time that the sense of personal conflict first obtruded. He had merely to shut his eyes in order to materialize a tall, large-featured man carefully pacing off the distances between 12 points, pacing them off in a sort of objective challenge to the unborn future. George Washington. The man Washington had from the beginning possessed an affinity for numbers. It had remained with him all his life, to count things not so much for the sake of the things, perhaps as for the counting, had been for the utmost importance to him. As a boy in Mr. Williams's school in Westmoreland, he excelled in arithmetic, long division, subtraction, weights and measures. To calculate cords of wood and pecks of peas, pints and gallons, and others. Young George delighted in these as other boys delighted in horseplay. As a man, he merely directed his passion into the channel of his possessions. Through his possessions, he apparently satisfied his curious need for enumeration. He was not content simply to keep accounts of the acreage he owned, its yield, his slaves, his pound and pence. Ellery recalled the extraordinary case of Washington and the seed. He once calculated the number of seeds in a pound troy weight of red clover. Not appeased by the statistics on red clover, Washington then went to work on a pound of timothy seed. His conclusions were 71,000 and 298,000. His appetite unsatisfied, he therefore fell upon the problem of New River grass. Here he tackled a calculation worthy of his prowess. His mathematical labors produced the great pacifying figure, 844,800. This man was so obsessed with numbers, Ellery thought, staring at the ruins of Washington's Grove, that he counted the windows in each house of his Mount Vernon estate and the number of panes in each window of the house, and then triumphantly recorded the exact number of each in his own handwriting. It was like a hunger, requiring periodic satiation. In 1747, as a boy of 15, George Washington drew a plan of major law, Washington's turnip field as surveyed by me. In 1786, at the age of 54, General Washington, the most famous man in the world, occupied himself with determining the exact elevation of his piazza above the Potomac's high watermark. No doubt he experienced a warmer satisfaction thereafter for knowing that when he sat upon his piazza, looking down upon the river, he was sitting exactly 124 feet 10 1/2 inches above it.
And in 1791, as President of the United States, Ellery mused, he was striding about right here, setting saplings into the ground, distant 15 yards from one another, 12 of them in an equilateral triangle, and beneath one of them he buried a copper case containing his sword and the half-dizzy coined from his own silver. Beneath one of them. But it was not beneath one of them. Or had it been? And had it a long time ago been dug up by a clerk? But the story had apparently died with Simeon and Sarah. On the other hand, Ellery found himself irrationally reluctant to conclude the obvious. George Washington's lifelong absorption with figures kept intruding. 12 trees, equidistant, in an equilateral triangle. What is it? He kept asking himself, almost angrily. Why isn't it satisfying me? And then, in the gathering dusk, a very odd explanation insinuated it because it wouldn't have satisfied him. Oh, that's silly, Ellery said to himself abruptly. It has all the earmarks of a satisfying experience. There is no more satisfying figure in all geometry than an equilateral triangle. It is closed, symmetrical, definite, a whole and balanced and finished thing. But it wouldn't have satisfied George Washington for all its symmetry and perfection. Then perhaps there is a symmetry and perfection beyond the cold beauty of figures. At that point, Ellery began to question his own postulates. Lost in the dark and to his time, they found him at 10:30, crouched on the cultivator seat, numb and staring. He permitted himself to be led into the house. He suffered Nicky to subject him to the indignity of having his shoes and socks stripped off and his frozen feet rubbed to life. He ate Martha Clark's dinner, all with a detachment and an indifference which alarmed the girls and even made old Tobias look uneasy. "If it's going to have this effect on him," began Martha, and then she said, "Ellery, give it up, forget it." But she had to shake him before he heard her. He shook his head. "No, they're there." "Where?" cried the girls simultaneously. "In Washington's Grove." "You found 'em?" croaked Tobias Clark, half rising. "No." The Clarks and Nicky exchanged glances. "Then how do you know they're there?" asked Nicky gently. Ellery looked bewildered. "Darned if I know how," he said, and even laughed a little bit. "Maybe George Washington told me." Then he stopped laughing and went into the firelit parlor and, pointedly, slid the door shut. At 10 minutes past midnight, Martha Clark gave up the contest. "Isn't he ever going to come out of there?" she said, yawning. "You never can tell what Ellery will do," replied Nicky. "Well, I can't keep my eyes open another minute." "Funny," said Nicky. "I'm not the least bit sleepy." "You city girls, you country girls." They laughed. Then they stopped laughing, and for a moment there was no sound in the kitchen but the patient century walk of the grandfather clock and the snores of Tobias assaulting the ceiling from above. "Well," said Martha. Then she said, "I just can't. Are you staying up, Nicky?" "Yeah, for a little while. You go to bed, Martha." "Yes, well, good night." "Good night, Martha." At the door, Martha turned suddenly. "Did he say George Washington told him?" "Yeah." Martha went rather quickly up the stairs. Nicky waited 15 minutes, then she tiptoed to the foot of the stairs and listened. She heard Tobias snuffling and snorting as he turned over in his bed, and an uneasy moan from the direction of Martha's bedroom, as if she were dreaming an unwholesome dream. Nicky set her jaw grimly and went to the parlor doors and slid them open.
Ellery was on his knees before the fire. His elbows were resting on the floor. His face was propped in his hands. In this attitude, his posterior was considerably higher than his head.
Ellery?
Huh?
Ellery, what on earth?
Nicky, I thought you'd gone to bed long ago. In the firelight, his face was haggard.
But what have you been doing? You look exhausted.
I am. I've been wrestling with a man who could bend a horseshoe with his naked hands. A very strong man. In more ways than one.
What are you talking about? Who?
George Washington. Go to bed, Nicky.
George Washington?
Go to bed.
Wrestling with him?
Trying to break through his defenses. Get into his mind. It's not an easy mind to get into. He's been dead such a long time. That makes the difference. The dead are stubborn, Nicky.
Aren't you going to bed?
Nicky backed out, shivering. This house was icy. It was even icier when an inhuman bellow, accompanied by a thunder that shook the revolutionary walls of her bedroom, brought Nicky out of the bed with a yelping leap. But it was only Ellery. He was somewhere up the hall in the first glacial light of dawn, hammering on Martha Clark's door.
Martha! Martha! Wake up, damn you, and tell me where I can find a book in this damned house. A biography of Washington, a history of the United States, an almanac, anything.
The parlor fire had long since given up the ghost. Nicky and Martha in wrappers and Tobias Clark in an ancient bathrobe over his marbled long underwear stood around shivering and bewildered as a disheveled, demonic Ellery leafed eagerly through a 1921 edition of the Farmer's Factbook and Complete Compendium.
Here it is!
The words shot out of his mouth like bullets leaving puffs of smoke.
What is it, Ellery? What on earth are you looking for?
He's loony, I tell you.
Ellery turned with a look of ineffable peace, closing the book.
That's it,
he said. That's it.
What's it?
Vermont. The state of Vermont.
Vermont?
Vermont. Vermont. What's in the crawlin' creepers Vermont got to do with it? Vermont, said Ellery with a tired smile, did not enter the Union until March 4th, 1791.
So that proves it, don't you see?
Proves what? Shrieked Nicky.
Where George Washington buried his sword in half Disney.
Because, said Ellery in the rapidly lightening dawn behind the barn, Vermont was the 14th state to do so. The 14th. Tobias, would you get me an axe, please?
An axe, mumbled Tobias. He shuffled away, shaking his head.
Come on, Ellery. I'm dying of cold,
chattered Nicky, dancing up and down before the cultivator.
Ellery, said Martha piteously, I don't understand any of this.
Oh, it's very simple, Martha. Thank you, Tobias.
As simple, said Ellery, as simple arithmetic.
Numbers, my dears, numbers tell this remarkable story. Numbers and their influence on our first president, who was, above all things, a number man. That was my key. I merely had to discover the lock to fit it into. Vermont was the lock, and the doors open.
Nicky seated herself on the cultivator. You had to give Ellery his head in a situation like this. You couldn't drive him for beans. Well, she thought grudgingly, seeing how pale and how tired-looking he was after a night's wrestling with George Washington. He's earned it.
The number was wrong, said Ellery solemnly, leaning on Tobias's axe. 12 trees. Washington apparently planted 12 trees.
Simeon Clark's diary never did mention the number 12, but the evidence seemed unquestionable. There were 12 oaks in an equilateral triangle, each one 15 yards from its neighbor. And yet, I felt that 12 oaks couldn't be perfect as a triangle was. Not if they were planted by George Washington, not on February the 22nd, new style, in the year of our Lord, 1791. Because on February the 22nd, 1791, in fact until March the 4th, when Vermont entered the Union to swell its original number by one, there was another number in the United States so important, so revered, so much a part of the common speech and the common living and dying, that it was more than a number. It was solemn and a sacred thing, almost not a number at all. It overshadowed the other numbers like the still unborn Paul Bunyan. It was memorialized on the new American flag in the number of its stars and the number of its stripes. It was a number of which George Washington was the standard bearer, the head and only recently the strong right arm of the new republic, which had been born out of the blood and muscle of its integers. It was a number which was in the hearts and minds and mouths of all Americans. Nope. If George Washington, who was not merely the living symbol of all of this, but carried with him that extraordinary compulsion toward number which characterized his whole temperament, besides, had wished to plant a number of oak trees to commemorate a birthday visit in the year 1791, he could have, selected only one number out of all the mathematic trillions at his command, the number 13. The sun was looking over the edge of Pennsylvania at Washington's Grove. George Washington planted 13 trees here that day, and under one of them he buried Paul Revere's copper case. 12 of the trees he arranged in an equilateral triangle, and we know that the historic treasure was not under any of the 12. Therefore, he must have buried the case under the 13th. A 13th oak sapling which grew to oakhood and, sometime during the past century and a half, withered and died and vanished so utterly it left no trace, not even its roots. Where would Washington have planted that 13th oak? Because beneath the spot where it once stood, there lies the copper case containing his sword and the first coin to be struck off in the new United States. And Ellery glanced tenderly at the cherry sapling, which Tobias Clark had set into the earth in the middle of Washington's Grove 6 years before. Washington the surveyor, the geometer, the man whose mind cried out for integral symmetries, obviously in only one place, in the center of the triangle. Any other place would be unthinkable. And Ellery hefted Tobias's axe and strode toward the six-year-old tree. He raised the axe. But suddenly he lowered it and turned and said in a rather startled way, "See here, isn't today Washington's birthday?" said Nicky. Ellery grinned and began to chop down the tree. Well, dear listeners, that's going to do it for this episode of the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Keith Tyler saying thanks for joining me. Tune in again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.